When Dominic Dunne died this past August, he left behind the manuscript of his final novel, Too Much Money, in which he skewered the rich and famous in a thinly veiled Romana Clay. It was his seventh novel, and there were also four volumes of nonfiction. Mr. Dunne was a special correspondent for Vanity Fair for 25 years and the host of the TV series Dominic Dunne's Power, Privilege, and Justice. He is the subject of Christy DeGaris and Timothy Jolly's documentary, now available on DVD, called Dominic Dunne After the Party. Mr. Dunne's son, the actor, director, and producer Griffin Dunne, visited our show last month to discuss his father's fascinating life and his novel. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed that conversation, and we thought we would re-air it for you today. I began by noting that in her New York Times review of Too Much Money, Janet Maslin wrote, Dominic Dunne had most assuredly used the book to settle scores. And I asked his son, Griffin, do you think that's true?
Well, he had made several attempts to finish the book at various times, and it sort of touches on almost the dramas and traumas that happened in his life, particularly with the Condit case, and he used exactly what issues we're facing. I don't know. I think, you know, Lily Soffer is obviously a Romana Clef and Gary Condit. So I'm sure that they aren't not fans of the book. So I don't know that it's settled, but he certainly didn't make any friends.
Well, Truman Capote got himself into trouble when he wrote these kinds of books. But your father must have known that he was not well and that this book was probably going to be published after he died.
Yeah, you know, he almost held on until he finished the book. It was the last, his last sort of mission. But even in his previous books, he seemed to have a Teflon factor. He never got the Truman Capote banishment, and I thought he'd. I always thought it would. I waited for that shoe to drop all the time. I always thought he was pushing his luck, but it never happened. I was amazed.
The novel is set in the rarefied world of the very rich, mostly on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and part of the fun is trying to decipher the not terribly cryptic names for characters. The talk show host Harry Sovereign is obviously Larry King. The 105-year-old grand dame Adele Harcourt is obviously Brooke Astor. The comatose heiress Antonia von Rautbort is Sonny von Bülow.
Don't forget, Grafton is Griffin.
That's
my name in it. He calls me Grafton. I don't know where he came up with that.
You have never done anything that was Grafton-y?
No, I've never heard. I don't even know anyone named Grafton, but yes, go ahead.
Does every character have a real-life counterpart as far as you know?
Yes, I believe so, pretty much right across the board. And what was interesting about this was when he wrote A City Not My Own, he used the real celebrity names, but the fictitious characters, who were based on real people as well, he came up with thinly veiled names. So this was sort of going back to, you know, the thinly veiled names all the way across the board.
And at the center of the book is Gus Bailey, a writer and TV host who chronicles crime among the rich and famous, who has appeared in some of the previous books, I guess. Does anyone doubt that Gus is your father's alter ego?
I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, in one of his books, it must have been, again, A City Not My Own, he went out and had Gus killed. He had him murdered by the guy who killed Versace, a roving serial killer, and he always regretted it. And he goes, oh, my God, why the hell did I kill myself off like that? So we came up with a device that, you know, you'll see in the book of how we could bring him back to life.
He could just have ignored it. Writers have done that.
I know. He was quite tormented about, how to quite bring him back.
But he also could have written this as a memoir. Maybe he couldn't have, if he had written it as a memoir, he might have had to be a bit more discreet.
I don't think so. I think he had always planned, you know, if he had another book in him, it was going to be a memoir. And that would have been the settling scores, and you know, his extraordinary life.
On the other hand, this gives him a chance to get into the minds of a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And we get detailed descriptions of the fabulous apartments, the private planes, the dinner parties, the couture outfits, the gold cigarette cases, even floral arrangements. Did he want everyone to know not only that he attended all those parties, but that he was paying attention to all the details? And it seems pricing the things yeah. in his mind.
Yeah, he had an eye for that long before he became a writer. He would have been a great sack decorator. I mean, he knew the provenance of antiques and the value of floral arrangements and who the florists were. He was obsessed with those details.
Well, you wonder sometimes whether he was as admiring as he was critical of those things.
Or at times even envious. You know, he always described himself as a kid who was, you know, had his face up, pushed up against the glass, you know, looking at movie stars and rich people and socialites. It was always a world that he very much wanted to be a part of.
Well, but he was.
And then he became it. Yeah.
I mean, he once told me that during the O.J. trial, every night he went to Elizabeth Taylor's house to tell her what had happened, and mm-hmm. once a week he went to Nancy Reagan's house to tell her what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know he was very proud of that.
Very.
That meant he was a privileged person.
Correct. And a peer, whereas before he was a writer, he might have been in those living rooms, but he never quite felt, you know, that he deserved to be.
When the book opens, Gus is embroiled in an $11 million slander lawsuit brought by a congressman named Kyle Crampton because of Gus's reporting on an intern's disappearance. That had happened.
Yeah.
Gary Condit had sued him
mm-hmm.
Over the Chandra Levy case for $11 million.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what would have happened, you know, as a result. It was settled out of court after a lot of legal expenses on both sides, I would imagine. And it came about from, you know, Dad loved to tell stories. And it seemed like a baseless case, but nonetheless, it was a drive-by slander. And he just loved talking about, you know, the possibility of this Chandra Levy being thrown out of a plane. It was something he heard. So that you could be sued for passing on information you'd already heard. It would have been an interesting case. But it absolutely tormented him while at the depositions and the costs, and it took a real toll on his psychology.
And Gus is distraught
yeah.
in the book as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's exact parallel.
Why do you think he wrote some? He was so fascinated by all of these high profile cases that involve murders.
Well, you know, I don't think that's he would have found that voice and that desire to expose the flaws in the court system had he not lost his daughter and my sister.
Dominique,
yeah.
She was an actress who'd
yeah.
starred in the movie Poltergeist, and she was killed in rather horrific circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. And she was murdered and strangled, and there was a trial, and there was a travesty of justice took place, and her name was slandered, and the killer got off and did a year and a half, and that changed all of our lives, and it certainly changed his, and he became a real voice for, you know, exposing the corruption and having of justice, and if you have too much money, you can buy your freedom.
Well, so the guy who killed her only got 2.5 years.
2.5 years.
We have a clip that we'd like to play from Justice.
It took him 5 minutes to kill her, and he got 2.5 years in prison. And this judge thanked the jury on behalf of both families. And I stood up in the courtroom, and I said, not my family. Don't thank them on behalf of my family. And I screamed at him in the courtroom, and the bailiffs took hold of me like this and carried me out, and I still kept screaming at him. And I said, you kept important information away from this jury. I ruined him.
You sure did.
All the time you were pursuing a career in movies. But did you get involved in these things?
Oh, yeah. I was leading a very surreal life at the time because I was doing a very kind of silly broad comedy called Johnny Dangerously. And so I would go from the – and it was in – we were shooting at 20th Century Fox, which is right near the courthouse. And on the days I wasn't shooting, I would be in the courtroom listening to the most grueling testimony. And then I would – on the – you know, the next day I would go to the set and, you know, laugh uproariously with Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito. And then go – you know, it was just a completely crazy existence for us all, really.
The book we're – well, I'm talking with Griffin Dunn about a book his father wrote, the last novel his father wrote, called Too Much Money. It's published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The villain of the piece seems to be Perla Zacharias, whose husband Constantine died in a suspicious fire. She seems to be based on Lily Safro, whose husband Edmund died under similar circumstances, the man who created Republic National Bank. Mm. That's now, I guess, been bought up by HSBC.
Exactly.
In the novel, Perla does her best to stop Gus from writing a novel based on her case. Did the same thing happen?
Yes. And it was a novel. Portia, it wasn't so much a novel. I think writing in might have been an article. He always wanted to write about it for Vanity Fair.
Do people put a lot of pressure on him or the publication to prevent him from doing that sort of thing?
I'm not really sure. I know that he – I don't know the specifics of it. I know that he always felt that he was a target of – in her sights, that he would open himself up to – too liable and to and he was he as scared as he was of her, he also was obsessed with her and could not stop writing about it and talking about her.
Well, this is a problem, especially if you've been sued for $11 million.
Yes, exactly.
One aspect of New York society that plays a part in the story is the role of walkers, gay men who accompany society women to charity balls, to dinner parties and the like. And one of them decides to commit suicide because he's over 90 and riddled with cancer. Why do you think your father wanted to write about these men?
Well, I think he knew them. He knew them very well. I mean, he certainly knew I think that's a combination of part of an aspect of himself, you know.
Gus reveals that he is gay.
And that's very – that character is very much of his alter ego. And he certainly never, you know, made that public before and very clearly decided to make it public in the last chapter of his book, of the last book he would write. So,
well, Gus says, can't die with a secret, you know.
Right.
So this is a way of coming out before he died?
Yeah, I guess so.
But a lot of people suspected that.
Yeah, it was not a burning issue, but I think it was important for him. He's always been incredibly honest about himself, and it's not that he's been dishonest, but he's been sort of withholding, and we haven't been particularly probing or interested. But I think it was important that he acknowledge.
Well, the whole matter of manliness was an issue in his life. In the film Dominic Dunn, After the Party, he talks about how his father, your grandfather, used to beat him and call him a sissy. And I'm assuming that he did that more with Dominic than with
apparently
his brother, John Gregory Dunn.
Yeah, none of the other brothers. John didn't even actually have a memory of that at all. I mean, there was an age difference, quite an age difference between the two of them. But no, I think that those beatings were reserved just for Dad.
Did his father's attitude change after he won a Bronze Star during World War II?
You know, that was a conversation when he was dying that we would return to all the time because he said that his father won that belt and never came out again. He did not lift a hand on him. He was kind of shocked, his father, that he, of all people, would be the Bronze Star winner and not his older brother, who was the great athlete and would assumed would be come home decked with medals. But so it was an amazing thing that Dad got the Bronze Star to him. But the man apparently never mentioned it. He never acknowledged, hey, good work on the medal, or, you know, they never had that moment. But Dad did feel that he didn't need his acceptance anymore, and he wasn't afraid of him anymore either.
Did your father ask you to do the book tour for him?
Yeah, it was, you know, at the very, very end, the people from Crown would came by his hospital room and then to his apartment with the final galleys, with the art book, the book you have right there with the what it looks like, and he was so pleased to know that this was really going to take off, and it is something that I talked to Crown about while Dad was alive, you know, of doing this role, of which I've done, you know, just a few, and I know he would have wanted it very much. He certainly was a friend of the media.
And I'm assuming that he was able to go over the galleys,
yes,
and make comments, because it was an unfinished last draft, wasn't it?
It was, it was, I'm just trying to think what stage was it. It was finished, but it required some editing. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, I think his editor, you know, put it, you know, just helped with some deletions and stuff like that, bringing it together.
Well, but the fact that he was a writer is a far cry from where his career began. He began in television as a stage manager for the Howdy Doody show.
Yeah.
How did he get that job?
Well, you know, in those days of television, they practically grab people off the street to come into a studio. It was a completely untried medium, and all experimental. And people, if you had any kind of stage experience, you'd think he'd, you know, put on plays in college. So that was enough to put him on the floor of a television studio.
But then he moved to Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
Became a producer. You were born in New York. Where is your birth in all of this?
Yeah, I was born in New York when he was in live television. He was there, Playhouse Nighty. He was.
So this is after Hollywood.
No. This is in New York. Mm-hmm. And when I was 2 years old, his boss at Playhouse Nighty, Martin Manulis, got a job in to run a studio, a television studio in Los Angeles, and brought my dad, and Dad brought us.
Well, this was a time when television was going through the transition, and things were going to be filmed instead, and everything then got moved to Hollywood instead of done live with the theater people here in New York. And your father seemed to be intent on meeting everybody. What did that mean for you as a kid?
Well, he was pretty distracted. You know, as he's the first to, you know, really make fun of what his priorities were during those early California years, because he's the first to say it. He's a social climber. He loved the glow of the famous and the important and the powerful, and he liked giving parties and having them in his home and getting them drinks and watching them get sloshed and having great stories, and he loved taking their pictures. And he kept scrapbooks of all of his evenings and kept the invitations. And this was a, you know, chronicling this, even though he was not a writer, he was chronicling it, you know, as if it was his own personal diary.
And that became his basic source material.
Exactly.
Social climbers and the people they want to be part of.
Exactly. It all was there for a reason.
I'm speaking with Griffin Dunn, who's talking about his father's last novel, Too Much Money, about the very old moneyed rich of New York, and some of the newcomers. The book is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with an interview I did with actor, director, and producer Griffin Dunn back in January. He was on our show to discuss the life and last novel of his late father, Dominic Dunn. During our conversation, I played this clip.
You know, going broke, if you've had money and you've lived among the rich, and all of a sudden everything's gone, the Mercedes goes, the thing, you don't have the house anymore, you don't have this, you don't have that, you don't have the thing, it's a terrible experience. But failure, if you get through it and you come out the other end, it is a great experience to have had. And you begin to understand, at least I did, how I was the architect of my own failure.
And I asked Griffin Dunn, can you tell us a bit about what your father was referring to in that and how it related to Sue Mangers?
Yeah, it's a story of some dispute, but the story that he tells is how he had a real problem with his mouth, that where he would just, it's what got him sued by Condit years later, and this is before he became a writer, but he just, too much information. He just kind of couldn't stop. And at that time he was drinking. So he told...
Later took drugs. He was trying to smuggle pot into the country from Mexico.
Yeah, well, smuggle. He didn't even notice he had a joint in his pocket. We went to pick him up at the airport. We were little kids, and we saw him be dragged across the airport floor with his feet dragging along the floor in handcuffs. But at that time, he told a story, and I don't really remember what it was. That was, he was drunk, and it was supposed to be
hilarious. Well, we have a clip of him talking about it.
Oh,
we listen?
Great. Sure.
There was a very powerful, powerful woman called Sue Mangers. They called her the most powerful woman in Hollywood at that time. She was very funny, also. She was heavy. I said, if the history of this movie is ever written, it should be called When a Fat Girl Falls in Love. It was hilarious at the moment. It was not hilarious when it was 2 weeks later written in the Hollywood Reporter. And it hurt her terribly. And I got a call from Bob Evans, who was very close to this woman. And he just said to me, you're through. You're over. You are over in Hollywood. And I was. And I knew it.
Now, he was talking, the film was Ash Wednesday, which starred Elizabeth Taylor and was written by Sue Menger's husband. But it didn't, your father was not through in Hollywood as far as Liz Taylor was concerned, because he continued to see her whenever he went out there.
Well, there's a difference between having dinner at somebody's house and working for a living. He was over in the movie business. And, you know, it would have helped if Ash Wednesday had good reviews or made some money, but it also happened to be a flop movie. You know, people can overlook, no matter what you say or what you, who you embezzle, if your pictures do well. So there was no excuse to revive his career. He was really over.
And that's when he had to become a writer full time.
Yeah, well,
he was a witty guy, and he could do that sort of thing.
Yeah, not without a great deal of struggle and soul searching. You know, I'd said earlier about how he has a sort of Teflon aspect that happened later on in life. Well, at those years, he didn't get away with anything. So if he said something about somebody, you know, who's powerful, it was in the paper. And he said that in Europe, and it ended up in the American newspapers. And his career was over. That kind of thing, he'd paid his dues, you know, on that side. So he went to Oregon, you know, broke, and he only went to Oregon because the car broke down in this town. And that's where he decided to write and kind of taught himself to write.
And then wound up in New York again around the time you wound up in New York. Now, did his problems in Hollywood affect you at all? Because you've had a very nice career in films.
I have, but I made a very conscious choice when I was 18 to come to New York instead of to start my career as an actor in New York, to get away from Hollywood, because I was very conscious of how he had been blackballed and his career was over, and I saw the, you know, what can happen. And I didn't need that kind of aura.
Well, when you became a producer, you had all the power yourself.
Yes.
You could ruin other people's lives.
Then I ended up actually pitching to the very people who probably wouldn't have hired my dad. So it was and I was producing at the time. I was 23 years old in my first movie, and at the very time that dad was banished as a producer in Hollywood.
That was an American Werewolf?
No, Chilly Scenes of Winter was the first one that I'd produced.
Oh, you produced that one.
I produced that one, yes.
It was just a pretty effective film.
Yeah, I love that movie. But I did American Werewolf after that.
Mm-hmm. And then Johnny Dangerously, you mentioned.
Johnny Dangerously.
After Hours.
Uh-huh. Yeah, which I produced. And I had a producing partner, Amy Robinson, and we did movies, Sidney Lumet and John Sayles and Martin Scorsese. We produced some really
good movies. Quiz Show was a pretty successful film.
Didn't produce that, but I was in that.
Yeah, you were in that.
And I've been, acting now again in, I put it aside to direct. I've directed some feature films, and I just did one that's out now called Accidental Husband, or at least just released on DVD, and anyway, busy.
So did you become a producer before you became an actor?
Well, yes, but not by choice. I couldn't get a job as an actor. But oddly enough, I could option a book and set up a motion picture. And I gave myself a part in the movie. That again, was Chilly Scenes of Winter. And everybody saw it. It was a very funny scene. And that started my work as a producer. I mean, as an actor.
Mm.
So I've been going back and forth in, you know, almost ADD-like fashion for 25 years.
Well, then your father wound up with the job that lasted until the end. He did know how to hold on to a job finally when he started writing for Vanity Fair. Did he get that initially because he was friends with Tina Brown?
No, he got – that came about when Tina was just starting up the magazine. She had just – was kind of staffing. No issues had come out yet, and Marie Brenner was her first contract writer. They'd met socially, my father and Tina, and – just before he went to Los Angeles to attend the trial, which we all did, it was very important that we all felt as a family we wanted our presence there for the jury to see us. Not that it did any good, but that was our thinking. And so he told Tina that he was going to be going there, why he was going to California. And she said to him, keep a diary of every day, of every moment of that experience. And he did. And he wrote his first piece, his first nonfiction piece called Justice. And that made him a Vanity Fair writer, and that changed his life as a writer, his perception of, how people thought of him.
How did John Swinney get away with 2.5 years
well,
for the murder of your sister?
Well, the jury was sent out of the room whenever there was he had previous a prior history of violence against women, previous women. When the women who were subpoenaed were testifying inexplicably, and I don't have an answer to this, the judge would dismiss the jury so that he could hear it and then decide, and then he decided it wasn't relevant when it was so clearly relevant. And he also, the jury also missed a moment where Sweeney got up out of his from behind the defense table, enough of this stuff. I'm out of here. I don't need to listen to this. And was wrestled to the floor by the bailiffs. So, I guess, and what they did, the jury did hear was, just excruciatingly negative, false, character assassination upon my sister. So somehow,
and so she brought her murder upon herself.
Exactly. It was like, it was a different time, in Justice too. It was.
She had MS.
No, that was my mother.
That's your mother.
But she was a young actress just starting out in her career.
He wanted to get your mother out of the courtroom,
sorry, yes.
Because she was in a wheelchair.
She
might
wheelchair.
Be sympathetic.
Yeah, and one time my brother, because of this horrible testimony, started to cry, and he said, that boy has tears in his eyes, that, get him out. So I think they somehow did it like the rich girl deserves it, which is very ironic because we really weren't rich. We were pretending we were, but we were from Beverly Hills, but it was like the poor kid killed the rich kid, and it was as simple as that.
But then that led to your father covering all of these different cases,
yeah.
And Graydon Carter said that he became Vanity Fair's signature writer,
mm-hmm.
actually helped shape Vanity Fair, the Vanity Fair that we know, covered the high-profile trials of O.J. Simpson, the Menendez brothers, Klaus von Bülow, William Kennedy Smith, Phil Spector, others, and in so many of these cases, the people got away with it. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
How about that? How about that? You know, you can have a lot of money to buy yourself a dream team defense, and for the most part, it really works.
But he then became one of the rich and famous himself. Did he enjoy the fact that people recognized him on the street?
Not a moment in his life went by that he didn't love it. He was always amazed. He was always stunned to be that cab drivers would call out his name, and I never saw anyone enjoy his own celebrity so much. You know, it was, and I think it can only, you can really only enjoy it after you've sort of been through as much downtime, you know, and tragedy, and you know, he really reinvented himself. So in his new incarnation to come back as a famous person was just his dream come true.
But how is that for you? I mean, you were working in the movie business where celebrity is a big issue that people have to work out for themselves.
You know, I've always been sort of had mixed feelings, I think, about it. Because, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, when I look at my own career, you know, when I was acting was starting to take off, then I would start to produce. You know, it would be deliberately. I followed up.
You mean to undermine the possibility?
I think I'm starting to, you know, kind of see a pattern here. It only took me 30 years, but I would take myself off the right after hours. I followed that up with 2 years of producing and being off the screen, and then once that happened, then I became a director, and now I'm going back to acting, and I'm developing something for me to act in and for HBO that I'm just going to focus on. I'm sort of fine with being a celebrity. Bring it on. Or I just want to keep working. I inherited my father's work ethic. And, you know, we both, like, aren't happy with ourselves in our lives if we're not doing what we enjoy.
My problem, I'm not a real celebrity, but people know who I am.
Sure.
And I go to parties, and suddenly I'm given all sorts of respect that I don't think that I deserve, that I've really earned. Mm. But it's partly because they know who I am and they've heard me on the air.
Sure.
And it's sometimes it's hard for me to work out for myself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a mixed feeling, you know. And especially when you see, you know, we're in a culture where it's now so craved and demanded, and there's so many incredibly famous people famous for being nothing. So it's, you know.
Your brother Alex was estranged from your father for a long time.
Yeah.
Did they make up before your father died?
Gratefully, they did.
And what about him and his brother John Gregory Dunn?
Oh, yeah.
Because there had been an estrangement for a time there.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
Now, that had happened some time ago. They'd seen each other. Dad had prostate cancer, and John had a heart murmur and, you know, heart problems. And they saw each other in the waiting room of at a clinic. And it was like, enough of this, you know? Life's too short. And you know, the great thing about being with Dad, you know, toward the end, was to see all of these relationships. I hate the word closure, but I've never seen it so much in action, you know, with Alex and all the people in his life who he was dying to see, who came in to see him. To people he'd been estranged from, who he wanted to see before, to say it's okay.
You talked about working on a project of your own. Is that adapting Meg Wolitzer's novel, The Position?
Yeah, that's one of them. Yeah, yeah.
Will you be producing, directing that, or are you going to act in that?
No, that's not an acting thing. That's a that will be directing and co-writing with Adam Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is to be acting in.
And meanwhile, we see you on television every once in a while, like Trust Me and Leverage. You were on Frasier for a while.
Frasier did that. Got a little Emmy number there.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, we have been talking about Dominic Dunn,
yeah.
Griffin Dunne's father, whose last novel was Too Much Money, a book that will tell you all sorts of things you might not have even worked out on page six and in the gossip columns, because there's an awful lot of insider information that perhaps he could not have written any other way without being sued for slander. There's also a documentary that is available on DVD called Dominic Dunne's After the Party. And I want to thank you so much for being
thank
with
you.
Us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you again.
You too, Larry.
And come by the next time one of these films opens.
Absolutely. Love to.